Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, how are things on the farm these days? Well, turns out, not so good. The crops are doing well, but many farmers say their costs are creating real problems. It's caused some to compare it to the farm crisis of the 1980s. Farmers also struggle with mental health issues, and a variety of factors make it less likely they get the help they need. We'll have a report. We'll talk with a pair of historians working to ensure Black history remains a visible part of Illinois. What happens when a hospital closes can create hurdles to care for many residents. We'll hear from the Illinois State Superintendent about new recommendations for AI use in schools. We'll also have a story on a piece of religious art in Western Illinois. And the legend of Bigfoot, it's as strong as ever. We'll have those stories and more coming up on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Well, first up this week, the majority of U.S. corn and soybean fields are in good condition this summer, but many farmers are worried whether they'll see a profit this year thanks to the high cost of supplies like fertilizer and diesel fuel. And as Hope Kerwin reports for Harvest Public Media, the widespread economic stress throughout farm country is drawing some comparisons to the farm crisis of the 1980s.
In southern Wisconsin, not far from the Illinois border, rows of green corn blanket Pat Malooly's family farm. The sixth-generation grower has had strong yields for both corn and soybeans during the past 2 years. Those abundant harvests have helped make up for low crop prices since 2024. But Malooly worries he won't have that to fall back on this year.
Sitting here today, our crop doesn't appear to be as good as last year.
He's hoping there will be enough at the end of the season to at least cover what he's had to spend to grow the crop. Profit margins for both corn and soybeans have been negative for the past 2 years, according to data from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. This year's cost of production is projected to be even higher, thanks to the war in Iran driving up the price of fertilizer and fuel. It's far from the first tough financial time Malooly's family has had to navigate. More than 4 decades ago, farmers faced another period of negative margins. By the end of the 1980s farm crisis, an estimated 300,000 farmers had defaulted on their loans. Malooly was a teenager at the time. He says it wasn't until much later that he understood how much his parents struggled to manage their debt and keep farming.
Horror stories of them not even getting the interest paid, you know, and putting that back on the debt. So it was very tough times back then.
The current struggle for row crop farmers to make a profit feels akin to the 80s. But ag economist Seth Meyer from the University of Missouri says that's where the comparison ends.
I think you just have a different system involved now than you used to have.
In the 80s, growers were forced to sell their farms in order to pay off debts. But Meyer, who was previously USDA's chief economist, says a landslide of foreclosures is unlikely to happen today, thanks to federal safety net programs. More producers use crop insurance, as well as government programs designed to offer financial support when crop prices fall.
I'd also say we've got a government that seems willing to inject a lot of money into the system.
Meyer says one-time aid payments, like the Trump administration's $12 billion assistance program, can help farms pay down their debts and survive until crop prices recover. But he says the influx of cash may also be keeping prices for farm supplies high. At the same time, interest rates have increased from the lows seen during the COVID-19 pandemic. They're still well below the roughly 20% charged by banks in the early 80s.
There weren't long-term fixed interest rates at that time.
Joe Springer is managing director of ag lending for Compeer Financial, working with farms in Illinois, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. And he says most farms are not carrying as much debt.
We're coming off a record years where our row crop producers made more money than maybe they ever had in their careers in the early 2020s here. And so that's different than what happened as we were going through the 80s.
But the profits from 2021 and 2022 are starting to run out. And Springer says farmers will need to think about how they're going to manage more volatility in markets in the coming years. Meyer says the impact of the current downturn will also depend on how much longer crop prices stay depressed.
Does this continue on for several years? In which case, you've already got folks that are trying to get themselves to next year.
In Wisconsin, Malooly is also thinking about next summer. despite months of work ahead to get to this year's harvest. He's already looking to lock in prices for some supplies, with the hope of guarding against future increases.
Everything we do is managing risk, and there's a cost to that.
He might end up paying too much if the cost of fuel or fertilizer comes down, and it's hard to predict what will happen to crop prices before next season. I'm Hope Kerwin, Harvest Public Media.
This story, the first in Tough Times, a Harvest Public Media series looking at the economic stress many American farmers are facing this year. Farmers also have one of the highest suicide rates of any occupation, and federal data shows the rates in rural communities tend to be higher than in urban areas. Alyssa Eaton reports financial stress and a lack of mental health resources can make it hard for farmers to get the help they need. And a note to listeners, this story mentions suicide.
Solomon Ham was born into a farm family in western Illinois. He says before he was born, his dad, Danny Ham, was a western Illinois political science student back in the 80s. But he dropped out of school suddenly to help his family run their farm full time.
My dad never wanted to be a farmer, really. He was kind of forced into that by his family because his dad had a heart attack and they were making it his duty to, like, take over his farm and everything.
Solomon, who's now an IT professional in Champaign, says his family suffered financially due to the challenging nature of running a farm.
You know, you take on a lot of debt from all that equipment, and you're harvesting crops, which there's a litany of things that can go wrong. There was that kind of feeling of instability just due to external stresses I couldn't fully comprehend at the time.
In 2002, the family was notified that the bank would foreclose on their farm. Danny's wife Giselle Ham says an attorney recommended they file for bankruptcy to settle their debts. She says her husband took this news really hard.
That's kind of a hard situation to be in, and Danny knew it. He had a mental breakdown. He really was more scattered and just really impulsive.
Giselle says around this time, the family's bankruptcy attorney asked if Danny had ever thought about taking his own life, to which he responded yes.
That just threw me for a loop. It just was a shock. I didn't envision that he would ever think of taking his life. So that was always in the back of my mind, that was a possibility from that point on.
Giselle says she tried to find mental health resources, but struggled. In their rural community, qualified mental health providers were few and far between.
Farmers and farm families, I think it's just a kind of very special situation, and people need to be trained in how to handle those special situations when, you know, a farmer loses his livelihood. We just struggled to find help and just kind of gave up trying to find mental health resources at that time.
Danny ended up leaving farming and jumped from job to job, mostly in sales. Then in 2022, he died from suicide. Solomon says one of the worst things was having to call people to tell them what had happened to his dad.
At first, you don't really believe it, right? When you hear that, you're just like, yeah.
He remembers his dad as always making people laugh and feel welcome. He says his favorite memories with him include playing guitar and going on drives.
I definitely miss playing for him, for sure. That was a good memory. I think it's important to check up on people who might seem, you know, seem even fine, you know, especially people like my dad.
In Northwest Champaign County stands a tall blue house. This is where Mark Horton, a corn and soybean farmer, lives. He says right now is a particularly challenging time for farmers. Over the past couple of years, he's had below average crop production on top of rising costs for essential equipment and rising interest rates for loans. There's just not enough money coming in to pay the bills.
I know what the banks are looking for, and what we have right now is not. You can't write the check. And that's an age-old problem.
Horton says it's important to have a support system.
I just know that people that are having a lot of struggle and don't have anyone to talk to, it's a super lonely place and it's a dangerous place. And we don't want that out here in the farm community.
He's glad to see programs like the Farm Family Resource Initiative crop up in recent years. Based out of Southern Illinois University, the program provides mental health resources to farmers and farm families.
These professionals who are trained in mental health, but they also understand agriculture and they understand farming.
That's Rachel Brown, a mental health specialist with the initiative. She says they offer individual counseling and support groups both in person and virtually so that people across the state can access them.
I've seen the folks who come to group really kind of build that support network there. There's a stigma that we kind of have to overcome to help people realize it's okay to need help, and the help is out there.
Solomon Hamm, whose dad died from suicide, says he's taken steps to find mental health support for himself and hopes that more people do the same.
With a better support system and better awareness and a decrease in the stigma of, you know, men can't have mental health issues or they'll feel weak and inadequate or something like that is what we need to get past if we're to prevent things like this from happening.
Alyssa Eaton with that report. If you or someone you know is in crisis, you can call, text, or chat with the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988. Illinois Secretary of State's office has a new statewide program aimed at helping drivers on the autism spectrum. Mawa Iqbal explains.
Neurodivergent drivers can now keep their license, vehicle registration, and proof of insurance in blue envelopes from their local DMV. The distinctive envelopes are meant to be visual cues to police officers during a traffic stop that the driver may have preferred communication methods. Secretary Alexi Janulia says routine traffic stops can be highly stressful for drivers with autism.
The flashing lights, the sirens, the police radio chatter, the uncertainty of what's happening and what's expected. Those sensory and communication challenges can quickly turn an already stressful situation into an overwhelming one.
Several local police departments across Illinois already administer blue envelopes. The statewide program will take effect in 2027. I'm Mawa Iqbal.
There have been a rash of sightings of the elusive creature known as Bigfoot or Sasquatch. While normally associated with the Pacific Northwest, the sightings have allegedly occurred all over the country, including Illinois and the Midwest. Netta Ulibi recently spotted Bigfoot's tracks on the American cultural landscape and thinks you may have too.
If you've driven in rural areas over the past few years, you've likely seen those Sasquatch silhouettes on people's front lawns and on bumper stickers that say, "Gone Squatchin'." And in New York City, Bigfoot inspired a critically acclaimed show called Bigfoot, A New Musical.
He's big and hairy, scary, nasty, and round. I'm talking about Bigfoot.
Bigfoot!
Bigfoot is now also in your phone as a brand new emoji. And this year brings half a dozen scary movies featuring the Sasquatch, including one called Slash Squatch. It seems the fearsome beast has learned to use an axe. It's not just low-budget horror. One of the buzziest new documentaries at this year's South by Southwest Film Festival delves into that famous footage from the late 1960s of a furry figure in the dense woods of Northern California.
We came around a bend in the creek, and there stood a big, hairy, human-like creature.
The new documentary is called Capturing Bigfoot. It uses this archival interview of Robert Gimlin, who helped make those blurry images that became well known in 1967, right when the modern environmental movement was taking off. Jessica Landau says Bigfoot became something wild to preserve.
There's a few counties in Washington state that have protected Bigfoot as an endangered species, and it's kind of a joke, but it's also a way to protect habitat.
Landau teaches at the University of Chicago and studies American mythologies around megafauna. Bigfoot, she says, reflects a romance with the frontier.
Bigfoot's huge. Bigfoot needs a lot of space, a lot of resources. So if Bigfoot exists, it means that there's a lot of spaces that are still wild. There's still something to explore.
Most Bigfoot sightings these days, she says, tend to be at state parks, like the ones last month that made national news.
I've had sightings at Walborn Reservoir. Deer Creek Reservoir.
That's a Bigfoot investigator named Glenn Adkins on a podcast called Bigfoot Society, discussing a recent spate of sightings in Northeast Ohio.
I tell everybody, they let us see them.
Maybe that's because of the new wave of Sasquatch calling contests at Bigfoot festivals around the country. Just within the past decade, dozens have popped up in small towns from Oregon and Washington to Tennessee and Maine. In Harrisburg, Illinois, the Shawnee Sasquatch Festival posted a calling contest on its social media.
Bigfoot does have this appeal in rural white communities and also provides some local pride.
Back in 2016, Jessica Landau was in rural Kentucky. She noticed a lot of pro-Trump bumper stickers stuck by Bigfoot ones. Now she writes about Bigfoot's resonance with aspects of conservative discourse.
A distrust of expertise. The scientific establishment has said, this is impossible, this doesn't exist.
Even in a joking way, Bigfoot, she says, reflects the value of doing your own research and standing up for beliefs you might feel are under attack. That makes sense to Mark Evans, who directed the new documentary, Capturing Bigfoot. He says his movie infuriated believers when they heard it debunked a key piece of Bigfoot evidence. He watched disinformation about it spiral in online Bigfoot communities.
The mistrust, the distrust, mistrust, misinformation. Maybe the film is AI. And then I even saw that I was AI.
Maybe Bigfoot, he says, does not just stand for a longing for untamed wilderness, but nostalgia for the days when photographs or film footage could be taken at face value before AI existed. It could be that Bigfoot's natural habitat is the world of fake news and conspiracy theories, as well as reality shows and on stage.
Bigfoot, Bigfoot.
Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
Remember, if you miss Statewide, you can listen to our podcast. That's available from the NPR app and where you get your podcasts. We'll be back with more on Statewide. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has opened a new visitor center in Nauvoo in western Illinois. The visitor center is designed to teach people about the church's original Nauvoo temple, the rebuilt temple there, and about the LDS faith. The temple itself is open only to church members in good standing. The visitor center includes historic artifacts and replicas, a children's activity area, and other features. One of the highlights is a towering Tiffany art glass depiction of Jesus Christ. Rich Egger tells us about the piece, which dates back to 1896.
You can't miss the piece when you walk in the front doors. It's straight ahead at the end of a long hallway.
I love beautiful art, and this is definitely beautiful art.
This is Susan Sims. She's the church's communication director for Iowa and Western Illinois. Not only is the piece straight ahead when you walk in, but it's illuminated from behind by 5,400 LED lights.
We believe that Jesus Christ is the light of the world, and this allows us to illustrate that with this piece.
The piece itself is nearly 10 feet tall and about 7.5 feet wide. The display case it's mounted in makes it seem even larger. Sims says the artwork's provenance remains a mystery. They know the piece was commissioned by a church, but they don't know which one. It was purchased by a private collector at some point and then spent at least 50 years in storage. Eventually, that private collector put it up on auction at a specialty auction house that deals in art glass from Tiffany.
This is not stained glass. This is art glass. This is leaded glass. Look at the folds in the drapery. This is 3D art, pieced together by hand by the Tiffany manufacturers.
Sims says it's a specifically commissioned, one-of-a-kind artwork.
You can't get this in Europe. You can't find this in New York. You're not going to see this in Chicago. It's nowhere else in the world but here.
The church believes the artwork was originally titled Christ Walking on Water in Front of a Field of Lilies. They've renamed it Come Unto Me. Juanita Coleman is the Illinois Historic Sites Manager for the LDS Church. Like Sims, she considers the piece an amazing work of art and remembers the first time she saw it fully assembled.
It kind of stopped you to a speechless point. It's awe-inspiring.
Coleman says as she watched the artwork being pieced together and restored in the visitor center, she thought about the meaning behind it.
Lilies are a form of peace around the world, and to have him standing in front of the lilies and in his white robes with his hands outstretched, you want to go to him.
Coleman says it's a beautiful way for people who come into the visitor center to be greeted, even though it's down a long hallway. Coleman says she's always been interested in history. She says the center is a place to connect history to the present day. And similar to the past, when local residents clashed with church leaders in the 1840s, there was some tension in Nauvoo when the church announced plans to build the visitor center. Some residents felt the church chose the wrong location. The visitor center is just down the street from the rebuilt temple and right across the street from Saints Peter and Paul Catholic Church. Opponents said that part of the small town is already congested. While there was some initial pushback, Susan Sims says no one is out there protesting today. She says people in Nauvoo moved on.
They're neighbors, they're friends, and I think they'll see that this can be a beautiful spot for them and be a good thing for the city. So whether it's smoothed over, if people still harbor some concerns, that's possible. But in general, in the conversations that I've had with people in town, they are understanding and it's just time to move on.
Church leaders held a dedication ceremony for the visitor center on June 27th. That's a significant date in the church's history. Founder Joseph Smith and his brother Hiram were killed in the nearby city of Carthage on June 27, 1844. And the rebuilt Nauvoo Temple was dedicated on June 27, 2002. Also this year on that date, church leaders dedicated the newly restored home built in Nauvoo by church leader Brigham Young in 1842. Like the visitor center, that is also now open to the public. Rich Egger reporting.
Welcome to This Week in Illinois History. I'm Clint Cargow. From 1809 to 1818, Illinois was a territory. It had only one governor, Ninian Edwards. When Illinois became a state in 1818, one of its first two senators sent to Washington, D.C., Ninian Edwards. When Illinois chose their third state governor in 1826, they elected Ninian Edwards. Edwards first entered public service in Kentucky in his teens. He became governor of Illinois Territory at 34. He used his legal expertise to sidestep the territory's anti-slavery laws, keeping all his slaves when he moved. Many of Illinois' early governors did this. In 1812, he introduced voting reforms, bringing more Illinoisans into the democratic process. It benefited only white males, but still made Illinois one of the country's most progressive territories. During the War of 1812, he led a raid on Native Americans near Peoria, killing several and burning their villages, only to find out he had attacked tribes friendly to the United States. He oversaw Illinois' transition to statehood, but bristled at Illinois being a free state. He was still a slave owner, after all. After a long political career, Edwards retired to Belleville to be a gentleman farmer. When cholera swept through in 1833, Edwards offered free medical care to the sick. He died of cholera on July 20th. Ninian Edwards left a complicated, contrary legacy, which is why a statue of Edwards was removed last month from Ninian Edwards Plaza in Edwardsville, and the park renamed City Plaza. I'm Clint Cargow, and that's This Week in Illinois History.
The Illinois State Board of Education has released guidance on using artificial intelligence in schools. State Superintendent Tony Sanders talked with Brian Sapp about the process and some recommendations.
Illinois took a little bit different of approach than other states. Our legislature actually compelled the State Board of Education to put together guidance for school districts K through 12. But rather than pulling together a group of state leaders, we actually went out worked collaboratively with our governor's office to solicit the best and brightest people from AI across the country. So we had a blue ribbon panel that came together over the last 7 to 8 months to really help us guide Illinois school districts on the latest, greatest around artificial intelligence. So what we ended up coming out with is a framework for how school districts can use AI to support teaching and learning and operations while keeping educators and students at the center of all that we do.
You're creating a framework. You're not saying a bunch of have to do this or must include this or you've got to use AI. Could you kind of dive into that kind of and how you're kind of trying to guide people to some best practices?
Absolutely. So, yeah, the core of this is that, again, teachers will always continue to teach and AI can be used as a tool to help in that process, but it'll never replace teachers 100%. So some of the things that that are incorporated in the report include some guidelines, right? So best practices for using AI within the context of your classroom gives some examples, an actual framework that teachers can use for working with any number of student groups, whether it's students with special needs, students that are learning a second language, and so forth. The guidance should be by giving teachers and leaders across school districts resources to help them regardless of what they intend to do with AI.
We're thinking about AI, it's new technology. What are some of the challenges that you hope that this addresses as we go forward and maybe turning us towards opportunities with AI?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of opportunity really to help ease for teachers really to ease their workload. So I'm hopeful that as AI continues to advance, the teachers will find ways to utilize it to free up their own time, whether that's helping to provide more immediate feedback to students on how they're doing without the teacher having to spend a lot of time, for example, reading papers every night. Anything we can do to lighten the load on teachers so that they can really focus in on their instructional practices is a benefit, I think, for Illinois kids. And I should have mentioned this when you talked about the tenants, is ensuring that we also keep student safety at the forefront. You don't, you know, teachers, administrators should not be uploading personally identifying information on their students into AI. So security is also one of those big topics within this report that needs to be considered by local school districts. But we didn't want to say, don't use it. I think right out of the gate, school districts, when AI and people first started playing with things like ChatGPT, there was this sudden movement in either districts either embraced it and went all in, or they just banned it. Illinois really wants a more holistic approach to AI. It's certainly a local district's prerogative to choose what they want to do with it. But we wanted to recognize in this report that there can be some benefits from using AI within classrooms.
I found interesting that you brought in people that are involved in AI. It's not just people trying to have worries about it. How key was that in developing these guidelines and going through this process?
We had a team member that worked directly with me here at the state board. His name is Dr. Jason Helfer. He took the lead along with me in meeting with these truly internationally recognized people from institutions such as code.org, the Brookings Institute, the Patrick McGovern Foundation. I mean, we had some of the best and brightest AI minds really drafting this 300 plus page guidance for Illinois school districts. I think that's what really sets it apart from other states and how they approach. Now that this is done, the Blue Ribbon panel is of course thanked for their service, but now we're going to move forward and continue to have committees that will continue to review this guidance and provide additional resources for school districts. So right now we're in the process of putting together a call across the state for people to continue to engage in this process so that we can always make sure that our guidance is relevant and up to date.
That's Illinois State Superintendent Tony Sanders discussing the new guidance the state has released about AI use in schools. He spoke with Brian Sapp. It's been more than 3 months since a West Suburban Medical Center in Oak Park suddenly closed. Now patients nearby on Chicago's west side are traveling farther for care and ending up in crowded emergency departments at other hospitals. These are the unintended consequences when a community hospital shuts down. Doctors worry more hospitals like that could close, those that treat people who can expect to die younger compared to those in other parts of the city. Kristen Schorsch has more.
It's a hot afternoon in Austin on Chicago's west side, about 3 miles from West Suburban. Shantis Johnson sits on her couch and gently touches her large, round belly. She's due in August with twins. She wishes she could deliver them at West Suburban, where her other kids were born.
Once you know home, it's home. And West Suburban was home to me. I've been going there for a long time, so it's like they know you.
What Johnson worries about the most is what happens if there's an emergency. She and her kids use the ER and the walk-in clinic at West Suburban several times a year. Johnson has chronic asthma. She says she once drove herself to the hospital while struggling to breathe because it was close. She's not a fan of the other hospitals she's gone to.
What if people just start dying because they can't get to the hospital in time? That's my biggest fear.
Doctors worry patients who relied on West Suburban are falling through the cracks. The hospital is across the street from Austin. It's more common here for people to die of cancer and heart disease or from being shot compared to other parts of the city. Before West Suburban closed, Megan Nolan knew what to do for her patients. She's director of reproductive services with a large group of clinics that was closely intertwined with West Suburban for years. For instance, if a pregnant patient needed an ultrasound the same day,
he used to call up Larry, radiology, and ask Larry to pencil a patient in. They would see them, and Larry would call me back and tell me what was going on.
Now Nolan asks, where do those patients go? But she's good in a crisis, so she leans in, tapping her running list of resources. She has to consider a lot more to help her patients. How would they get to another hospital? Is it accessible by public transit? Do they take a patient's insurance, if they have any?
It's this, like a chess game of where do they go? How do they get there? You know, I've worked in Austin for almost 11 years, and like most of my patients could walk to West Sub.
Several doctors who spent decades at West Suburban question if the state is doing enough. They want Governor J.B. Pritzker and others in power to hold hospitals more accountable for the taxpayer money they get. More than a dozen hospitals owe the state at least $650 million. Most are known as safety nets, treating low-income people who have public health insurance, or none at all. West Suburban's CEO shut the doors and closed another hospital last year, owing the state more than $100 million. Dr. George Narottam is a kidney specialist. He worked at West Suburban for about 16 years.
Why are these various governing bodies concerned about what happened to the money? You know what I mean? That's what bothers me.
Pritzker and leaders of state agencies overseeing hospitals declined interviews. Next year, the pressure on hospitals will get worse. Big cuts to Medicaid public health insurance kick in. More than 400,000 people across Illinois could lose coverage. That's less money flowing to hospitals already stretched thin. The doctors worry, what if another suddenly closes? One hospital absorbing West Suburban's patients, Community First Medical Center in Portage Park, is slammed. Margaret Polico is a nurse there in the ER.
We've gone to not having enough patients to within 2 weeks of West Sub closing, we don't have enough staff.
Community First was already struggling. The hospital owes the state a ton of money. Polico says some really sick patients are stuck in the ER, some on breathing machines, waiting to go to the intensive care unit because there aren't enough nurses upstairs. She says some patients who traveled from the west side are shocked at conditions in the ER. Two patients to a room, broken beds, sinks without running water.
The stuff that we just accept and live with is really ridiculous.
She equates it to MASH, the TV show where a surgical team works in a war zone. The doctors from West Suburban say the state needs to create a plan to fill the void the hospital's closure created, and for other communities where this could happen next. Kristen Schorsch, WBEZ News.
Much of the area was impacted by the Canadian wildfire smoke in the past week. The Illinois State climatologist says those wildfire conditions aren't rare for this time of the year, but the location of the fires is. Dr. Trent Ford says wildfire risks in central Canada are increasing due to long periods of heat and dryness. Shifting winds brought the smoke to the Midwest, and Ford says the upcoming forecast is for not as smoky conditions.
So that'll be great. But wildfires are still burning in Canada and Minnesota, which means that when the winds shift in the right direction, we will get more smoke. So this isn't something that's immediately going to go away for the rest of summer.
Ford recommends an N95 mask for people in sensitive groups or with pre-existing conditions. He also says it's wise to check the EPA's website daily for air quality conditions, even if the air does not appear to be hazy. We've got more to come on Statewide. Up next on Statewide, we continue with our series exploring Illinois connections to the 250th anniversary of the United States. It's created in partnership with Illinois Humanities. Two historians are working to ensure Black history remains a visible and lasting part of the state's legacy. Randy Eccles spoke with Connie Martin, an Illinois Humanities Rhodes Scholar and retired educator. She's researched the Underground Railroad through the tradition of quilt codes. Preserving more recent history is also the mission of Layla Wills, executive director of the Historical Preservation Society of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party. Wills is leading the creation of the Black Panther Party Heritage Trail, a project that identifies and commemorates important sites across Illinois, even where original buildings no longer stand. Here's Connie Martin.
The history evolves from our race evolving toward more and more freedoms that were granted and allowed to have legislatively, socially, academically, and politically. That's the reason why it's very important to know that if you know your background, to know your background and to share the background. My mother, talking about the quilt presentation, performing the quilt presentation for 16 years before she passed it on to me as a retirement from teaching present, included information about the Underground Railroad. And that's when I first started being interested in the Underground Railroad, which she started the presentations back in 2002. That's the year and date that she also published her book, Lizzie's Story, A Slave Family's Journey to Freedom. So I was not highly involved until I retired from teaching. And then she passed the presentation on to me, which was all lecture, then made quilt replicas to use in the presentation because the original quilts we have, my mother has them. I started doing more research on our family and doing more research on the Underground Railroad in general, being able to travel to 25 counties so far in Illinois and doing a little research on each county and each city I present in and create a slide to include in my presentations to tell the audience, this is the Underground Railroad stop in your city, or these are the abolitionists who were helpful in your city. How can we bring that to present day and make it important and justifiable to share to the next generation? That's how I became involved in doing the presentations. Now I have two different presentations, one's on the quilt codes and the other's on the hidden messages in Negro spirituals that were created by enslaved people on the Underground Railroad as well. I taught my children the quilt codes. My grandchildren are the eighth generation descendant. They're able to tell their friends and their schoolmates about the quilt codes that were highly secretive and didn't even come out into public view until a book was written in 1950.
The research has to be difficult because historical records weren't kept as well.
Many of the records were destroyed by the Union Army coming down into the southern slaveholding states. Many homes were burned. Many files were destroyed. Many records of accounts of slaves. Because now you have to go back to the county census and they have to go back to county records that actually maybe have had not only maybe records of enslaved people, but had records of their livestock. Now, if you go back and look at the records of their livestock, you may be able to find this particular slaveholder had 8 horses, 5 cows, 10 pigs, and 15 slaves. Because the slave records are with the property that they owned, which is their livestock. They were referred to as property. We know who our slave ancestors were. We know them from documented, that's better than DNA. We had records that were well kept through my great grandmother named Lizzie, who kept a family Bible.
Explain a little bit how the quilt comes together, what the different pieces are of the quilt.
The quilt code in our family was distributed among about 15 quilts, individual quilts. So each one quilt is the master quilt. We call it a sampler. The quilt sampler has several blocks. Each block is a pattern on the same quilt. That's the quilt sampler. That's not the main one that's used on the Underground Railroad. That's the one that's a teaching tool to teach the people who are granted the right to escape, because not everybody could escape. You had to be chosen to escape and go through a series of checks to make sure you're okay to be able to escape and become a freedom seeker. That was the key that you had to sit down and learn before you left on your journey, so that when you came across an individual quilt with one code in each quilt displayed on purpose, then you would know what that quilt meant. So you were told about the quilt codes before you left, so you would recognize it and know that you were going in the right direction. Each individual quilt has a pattern that all repeats on that same quilt. That is a code. For example, log cabin. Log cabin is a quilt that has squares inside of squares inside of squares, and then a center square in the center. If the center square in the middle of the log cabin was red, that means that it was not safe to stop at that moment, because slave catchers, bounty hunters, or law enforcement or slave traders could be near. So they had to wait until someone came out and put the one that had all black squares in the center. Or if it was a red one, they put a black square in the center, meaning it's safe. Or if it was all black, then they come put a red square anywhere in any one of them. Red in the middle of the log cabin block meant it was dangerous. They come out and they take it off and make it all black, and then it was safe to approach the house once they knock on the door and they say, I am a friend, or I am a friend of a friend, which meant that you were an abolitionist or an anti-slavery supporter, and it was safe for you to come in and rest. Get rest, sleep a night, get food, and then the next conductor would come pick you up and take you to the next safe stop. And there's many safe routes on Illinois that I'm sure we know. It's amazing to see how many routes go all the way up all to Chicago. I don't care what map you look at, every single route in Illinois from the junction of the Ohio River and the Mississippi River at Caro all the way across the state of Illinois, and then they all converge to one point, and that's Chicago. Everyone had to get to Chicago or you're not going to get free. That's where a multitude of abolitionists, both black and white, would be there to help you to get a boat to cross over Lake Michigan into Michigan, and then walking up to Detroit, get another boat, cross over Detroit River into Ontario. That's one route. There's another route that takes you up through Windsor, another route that takes you up through Niagara Falls, crossing over Niagara Falls through Niagara Falls, which is a hotbed of underground activity, into Nova Scotia to freedom. Why did they have to get to Canada? Because of Queen Victoria and her husband, Prince Albert. Prince Albert, who hated slavery, they both did, was the president of the Underground Railroad Convention in London at that time, and had a convention and invited African-American Underground Railroad activists to come and speak at their convention. Eventually, Britain outlawed slavery, Ireland, Scotland, Wales, all outlawed slavery, and British North America outlawed slavery in 1834. That's why, because of the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, everyone had to get to Canada, whether you are free or not, because that's where you could be truly free. Not free in Illinois, not free. Freedom seekers were not free. Some did stay, some did build homes in central Illinois, but not in southern Illinois. They were very pro-slavery in southern Illinois all for a long time.
That's the best explanation I've heard at the Underground Railroad. Thank you for illustrating that. Turning to Layla, you have a project going on similar. There's a trail in Illinois you're marking for the Black Panther Party.
When we first started doing the history of the Illinois chapter, the first thing you'll realize is how extensive the party's operations were in Illinois. They had operations all the way down to Carbondale and all the way up to Rockford and Waukegan. The Illinois chapter was also in charge of the entire Midwest region. Michigan, Ohio, Indiana all reported to the Illinois chapter. The other thing you'll notice is that just about all the properties were demolished through the years. I want people to remember how young the Black Panthers were. Some was young as 14, and then a lot was in between 14 and 19, and then you had some people that were over 20 years old. So it wasn't like they were property owners anyway, but they did operate out of churches, offices. Through time and gentrification, it could be even worse intentions why some of these places were demolished. We have to create places for the Black Panther Party where people would know that they were here in all of these neighborhoods. When you're growing up in an area that has totally changed, like if you go back to your old neighborhood, it's totally changed. So the new people there or children just now being born would be like, how come it's like this? And why haven't we been able to accomplish that? And they would think no one was here fighting for them. So it was also important for our community and collective memory to know that these struggles took place. We are placemaking. It's a public history project. We're starting out with 13 sites. 12 are in Chicago. One is in Peoria to place historical markers at these locations. We have a lot of public support, foundational support. We're working on the digital materials of the Heritage Trail that people can follow. They can see all the locations that we've mapped out, and they can visit these sites if they want to, as long as they know that sometimes there's just an empty lot that's there when they go to these locations.
Historical markers have been really important because when there's nothing left to see, you still know they're in that space and you usually can have some interpretation written on that marker. Is there a digital map already set up on a website somewhere where you can see where these either are or will be?
They can go to our website, ilbpp.org, as in Illinois Black Panther Party, ilbpp.org. And there are several maps on the website. They can see locations of the Illinois chapter, locations of the breakfast program, locations of Fred Hampton. They can see the 13 sites of our inaugural trail that is also already mapped out. We're working on more interpretive materials like narrations from the Black Panthers themselves, historical photos, research materials for researchers like demographics, news articles, some more material starting with the 13 sites.
Sounds like a great resource. And Illinois Humanities also has a resource put together of a variety of different things regarding Civil War, civil rights, Black history in Illinois. It's their Illinois Passport. You can find out more at il250.org. As you sit here now and think about this rich history you've reviewed for African American history, Black history, the 250th of the Declaration of Independence, which very much, for the most part, was a positive vision statement, where do you think we need to go next as far as honoring the aspirational parts of the Declaration of Independence?
250 years later, there are forces in place right now who are trying to take away or deplete or whitewash our Black history. And we as a people need to come together, both Black and white, red and brown, green and purple. Everybody needs to come together to try to fight that and lobby for the fact that we need to retain our information. And just because we are not of the same color, we need to respect other people's histories and leave their histories in place. We're losing the freedom of speech. So we need to remember that, yes, it's 250 years, but some people think that 250 years is want to be positive and celebrated. Not everybody feels it should be celebrated. So what do we do and how can we come together to make it understood that these freedoms we have earned need to stay in place? The history that we have created as Black people need to be there and stay in museums and stay in schools and stay in universities and continue to be talked about and spread and shared to the next generation so that younger people can still remember what happened and be able to have a better enriched life because they knew their history.
Leila, the Black Panther Party was a party that was facing a similar type of thing at the time they originated. How do you move forward? What type of representation is needed to make sure that the progress that has been made and the progress that still needs to be made continues to happen?
For us and our efforts and other historical efforts going on, a lot of the public history projects are very nuanced and people we would have never heard of if it wasn't for people like Connie and what we're doing and others that are bringing these stories out. The other piece of that is public school curriculum. That is the next frontier. We do have Black Panthers who are working on a curriculum. That's important where you're interpreting the history that you lived. Then you supplement that with actual facts of demographics and statistics.
Each person, whoever you are, whatever culture background you come from, that we are going to be able to continue to be proud of our heritage. We need to teach these little Black children to be proud of who they are and where they come from.
And history is not warm and fuzzy all the time. We must continue in the public space to make room for all of these stories. I did not agree when they tore down statues and relocated them. And then here we come with this kind of work that we're doing. And the Black Panther Party has a controversial history that we acknowledge, but we have to make room in the public square for all of this history. We don't do our future selves any benefit by erasing history, tearing it down, whitewashing it, acting like it didn't happen. I would like to see us all make room for all the different parts of American history.
Randy Eccles spoke with Connie Martin, an Illinois Humanities Rhodes Scholar and retired educator, and Layla Wills, Executive Director of the Historical Preservation Society of the Illinois Chapter of the Black Panther Party, part of a special series exploring Illinois connections to the 250th anniversary of the United States, created in partnership with Illinois Humanities. We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for joining us, and be with us again next week for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. You can find us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.